You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 13th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Good evening, everyone. So this is the last show that we're recording prior to leaving for our trip.
Yay.
Yes.
Yay. New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the next three episodes you hear were all previously recorded. They're all new, completely new episodes. They're just ones that we recorded earlier so that we would have them ready to go for this trip. And then we're getting into the five shows that we record while we're on the trip. Although we'll still be getting together in December to do the year-end show.
Yeah, we considered just playing episodes 1 through 4 again while we were gone, but we love you guys too much to do that.
Yeah.
So decided to make some fresh
ones.
Everyone
will be brand new content that we had 3 episodes ahead. You know, it's a lot of work. Then we're going to do 5 shows in 2 weeks, but then we'll have like a relative break for the holidays. We'll still be doing some new content, but have an easier schedule over the holidays. That's good. So, guys, I got 3 large boxes in the mail yesterday. You know what was in them?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. What?
Okay. Yeah. Gosh.
What's in, Amazon?
What's in the box?
Nothing, huh?
Oh.
Sex toys.
I know everything we're waiting for. I mean, but 3 large boxes isn't USB drives. It isn't coins.
I bet there was some packing material in those boxes. Is that right?
Probably some. Yeah, there's probably some.
Well, let me guess. You probably got an adapter for Australia, New Zealand, and maybe a raincoat like I did got today.
No. You're all completely incorrect. There were books in those boxes.
Oh.
From what country?
They were from – I was thinking that they were our Chinese version of
soft,
the book.
Yes. Soft cover then.
Yes. It's the soft cover. It's the soft cover of our book.
Oh, cool. Paperback.
Yep, the paperback.
I want it. Bring them tomorrow when I see you.
I want
slightly altered.
Or Friday.
Steve,
slightly.
You're now a paperback writer.
Oh, yes, I am. So on the front cover, there's a couple of changes. One, it says a USA Today bestseller. We're best-selling authors. Thank you. And there's a little moon, you know, in our starscape that says with a new bonus chapter.
Cool.
Yay.
Oh, I must have.
That's no yes. moon.
That's no moon.
That's
so,
a new chapter.
This is, my friends, the answer to all of your holiday shopping blues.
Absolutely.
It is. Because I understand this makes a wonderful present. Mm-hmm. You give the gift of critical thinking. So don't just give a present to the people you care about in your life this holiday season. Change their life for the better. Right?
Yes.
Absolutely. In fact, you should go out right now and buy 10 copies of the soft cover of a book. One for yourself.
Why buy 10 when you could buy 20?
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Some number that is equal to how many people in the world that you love. And then one for yourself just for that bonus chapter because it's totally worth it. But it's nice. It's very, very pretty. I like it in soft cover. I like soft cover books. I like hard cover books too because they kind of look cool on your shelf. But soft covers are a little bit more comfortable to read.
Agreed.
Yeah, paperbacks are definitely lighter in your backpack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's for sure.
That am true.
You can hold them with one hand easier.
I'm going to bring a copy with me on the flight. Can't wait to read it.
You're going to read your own book on the flight?
The new chapter. I haven't read the new chapter yet.
Ah, it's like, is that the guy in the band who like wears his own t-shirt to the concert?
I would do that. I wear
what's
SGU
wrong with that?
Shirts. I have a lot of SGU t-shirts I wear when we do stuff. Why is
That's
that
true.
Bad?
You wear them on stage, don't you?
I mean,
they're awesome.
Yeah, I like them too, but I don't usually wear them on stage unless it's like a coordinated thing. Like we're all going to wear our SGU shirts.
You guys want to know what the bonus chapter is about?
I know what it's about. You mean you want to do it? That was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, good pickup, Jay.
No, we do not.
They put it at the end of the book as a bonus chapter, and it's on global warming. So I did a really deep dive. Because, we talk about it a lot, sort of nibbling around the edges, but this is a chapter just all right, let's just delve into this and do.
So is it about climate denial?
Yeah, it's about climate denial.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. I always think climate denial is such a funny term that we use.
Climate change denial.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like they deny the climate, which I think they kind of do to some extent.
Yeah.
They sort of do.
They sort of do. Right?
Yeah, in a way, you sort of have to.
They kind of deny that climate is a thing and just constantly look at the weather.
Yeah, if you just close your eyes and your ears to the world, you know, life's simpler, right?
Yeah.
don't get me started because I'm talking to client deniers right now on Facebook.
Client deniers?
Them too.
Client. What? I'm sorry.
I am not your client.
You know what, Carrie? You want to know why you're hearing this level of confusion from me?
Why?
My daughter. Slept and you have two kids.
My 4-year-old woke me up at 4:30 this morning.
That's not a. That's like sometimes what time I go to bed.
Just once. I'm so jealous, Molly. My dog gets me up 3 times a night.
Why?
Ooh, that's
What's
rough.
Wrong with her?
She wants to eat and then she wants to poop.
Oh, she's an annoying little spoiled dog. That's what's wrong with her.
She's got me wrapped. I don't know how she did it. She wrapped me right around her paws, you know, because I could hear her. I'm a very light sleeper, so I hear her getting ready to bark, and I don't want to wake anybody else up. So I get up and deal with her so that nobody else gets awakened like I was. And it
did
just turned into this.
Did she sleep in your room?
Yeah. It just turned into this beast of a situation.
Oh, no, Bob.
I'm lucky. I can go right back to sleep. If I couldn't go right back to sleep, she'd be dead.
I still don't know how much that interrupts your REM cycles.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
When I go to
it's
my
really
bedroom and I start to get ready for bed, he comes with me and lays down in his bed. And it doesn't matter if I'm up at 5 a.m. for an early call time or if I sleep until noon. If mom's in bed, killer's in bed.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I love that.
He is
you want
so
trade?
Good at that.
Oh,
I know.
My gosh.
I will not trade him for anything. Also, by the way, he has been coming with me to the group home where I'm doing therapy, and it is incredible to see the change in some of the girls that I work with. Dogs are magic. Well, it's science, but still.
But Bob, everyone knows how that dog wrapped you around its paw. It's because you're a pushover.
Mm. But no, only with dogs?
She was masterful at it.
Yeah, the dogs are cute. That's their superpower.
It is. Those eyes.
Nah,
they
cuteness had nothing. Had nothing to do with it. It was just a slow, like the frog in the slowly boiling water.
She trained you. Is that what happened?
Yep.
I know it's hard. Like we have a new puppy who's adorable. I mean, it's a completely adorable dog, very friendly, loving. But you have to lay down the law, right? You have to give it tough love, no matter how cute it is. You know, when it does something you don't want it to do, you have to be firm. You know?
Yeah, you can't give into it because they're going to establish those patterns for life.
If you let it walk all over you, then forget about it. They'll run.
Your
run
REM
your
sleep will be ruined.
Right, Jay, how's your dog doing?
He's great. I mean, his big problem is that he likes to jump up on people because he wants to kiss them on their face, right?
Yeah. He's a face licker. He's a convicted
face
licker.
And he's a big dog, right?
Yeah, he's right now he's a medium-sized dog. I don't know how much bigger he's going to get. You know, he's got at least another 6 months of growing. So what's funny is my mother-in-law is what, 5'6", 5'6"? She's so the dog can jump at least 5'10". So the dog can jump up to her face without a problem, right? So he's very excited. She comes in, he jumps up, and he has this thing, and this happens, you know, pretty much every time she comes into my house. He jumps up and sticks his tongue in her mouth.
Gross.
Well,
that's so funny.
If you keep your mouth open will that happen.
It is so funny. I mean, I don't even try to stop him.
No, that's one of the real bummers about medium and big sized dogs is that you have to train certain behaviors out of them that you don't necessarily like. My dog is 10 pounds. He jumps and tries to lick you too, but he reaches mid shin.
Yeah.
Cute.
Sagan prefers ears. Like he goes right for your ear.
Aww.
And will lick your ear.
I taught Killer
early on that
he can't lick faces or kiss faces. So when people try to get him to give them kisses on the face, he turns his head away like he's really coy. So he's only a hands and feet person. But if you're wearing flip-flops, oof.
You go for your toes.
Sneak attacks in those toes. Yeah, you got to be careful.
Well... So run out there, rush out there and buy your copy of the software. I guess you don't know that they're actually available until early December, but you could probably pre-order them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And of course, when you do that, you'll support the SGU and you'll make the world a more skeptical place. So you got that going for you.
which is nice.
Which is nice. So, Evan, you learned something recently that you shared with me. Tell us about it.
Yeah, what I learned today, right, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
I was asked by one of the SGU listeners who also follows me on Facebook what I had thought about a particular product. And the link was to this product called Copper Zap. one word, Copperzap. So I went there to see what it was all about. It's a natural cold prevention device. It's basically this copper rod you hold in your hand with a tapered end, and you apply this copper to, say, your nostril area, and it's supposed to help you prevent all sorts of things from happening to you. Well, according to their website, prevent or stop flu, sinus trouble, congestion, cold sores, getting sick after air travel, and more. Okay, and I'm looking through this website. I'm looking about this. First of all, I'd never heard that copper, because all it is copper, it's all they're claiming it is, has some sort of cold prevention qualities to it. And as I'm looking through the website, this thing has anecdotes like you wouldn't believe, which pretty much, you know, makes up the first, well, it's all one big page, but the first, I'd say 80% of it is a lot of anecdotal evidence or anecdotal accounts from people who have bought it. So right there, I'm thinking, all right, well, this looks like crankery. This looks like a crank device. But I tried to do a little more research into the actual science of it, and lo and behold, I actually came across some things which seem to indicate that there is some truth here, that copper can help.
So, yeah, so then Evan asked me about it, so I wrote about it for Science-Based Medicine. By the way, before we finish this story, SBM, you may have some trouble reading the articles on there. We're under, like, a vicious DDoS attack right now.
I'm
Whoa.
Seeing that.
Jeez, I didn't see that. I was there yesterday. It wasn't happening.
Well, we're doing countermeasures, but like we're in the middle of a wrestling match right now with between our countermeasures and this. It's both Science-Based Medicine and my personal blog, Neurologica, are both under attack.
Give me a break.
I know.
It's all right. We're dealing with it.
We're dealing with it, but it's just a pain in the ass.
Yeah, you know? It is.
If you go to the article I wrote about it on Science-Based Medicine, that's why you have to wait for them to check out your browser for 5 seconds, because we're trying to protect ourselves from a DDoS attack. So Evan is correct. Copper, it's actually been long known, and there's good studies now which show that copper kills bacteria and viruses on contact, even like metallic, solid copper, for a couple of things, reasons. You know, for it gives up an ion which can cause oxidative stress, which can disrupt membranes by binding with proteins and inactivating them. So there are some mechanisms. It's pretty rapidly bactericidal, and also can denature, can break down viruses. But that's it. That's the evidence, right? And so the idea is that copper would be a good like surface for places that you need to be sterile, like in hospitals, you know, where where germs can transfer very, very easily. So bacteria, for example, that may survive for days on a stainless steel surface only survive for minutes on a copper surface.
Minutes.
Yeah. But, you know, you measure like the concentration of a virus or the concentration of bacteria, and it decreases even over minutes. You know, it decreases by orders of magnitude. But if you wanted to like really sterilize it, you'd have to, you know, leave it in contact for tens of minutes or an hour, let's say. But certainly there's a significant reduction even in 5 or 10 minutes of contact. So that's good. I mean, that actually is reasonably effective. And, you know, just having like a copper countertop or bed railing or whatever, you know, is benign. So there was one study I found where they actually put copper surfaces in an ICU room and then compared them to ICU rooms that didn't have it. And there was a significant reduction in hospital-acquired infections. So there's, you know, it's reasonably plausible that it could actually be useful in certain contexts. But let's go from this to the copper zapper, right? That you really can't extrapolate from the scientific evidence to that particular application, because, you know, like first of all, how much access are you going to get to the viruses that are already, like they say, users said that your first sign of a cold symptom, all right, it's too late at that point, right?
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense.
And you'd have to, you know, think about it. You'd have to put that thing up your nose. You'd have to get really deep, you know.
With a rubber hose.
You'd have to go all around your nose on both nostrils, and you'd have to leave it there for minutes. I mean, the whole procedure would probably take a really long time. And there's no evidence that it would even work because it hasn't been studied. You know.
Well, and isn't the virus at that point, the cold virus, all in your body? It's not just your epithelium anymore.
Exactly. Right. That's why it may not have any significant effect.
Yeah, you'd have to wear it in your nose all the time to prevent the virus from getting through your epithelium, which seems uncomfortable.
Yeah, so the clinical claims don't really flow from the basic science, you know. That's the thing. And the other thing I thought was, just as an aside, They're charging $69.95, so almost $70 for what is about a dollar's worth of copper.
You know? Yeah,
so it's a total ripoff.
That's for sure.
And in fact, so I looked up on Amazon, and you could find a similarly sized copper rod for like $2, $3. On one of the websites, one of the web pages, they show somebody holding like the flat end of the wand next to a cold sore. And like literally, you could be holding a penny next to your lip. And it's $69.94 cheaper than this wand. And even modern pennies are mostly zinc, but they're copper on the outside. They're coated with copper. So it's, you want copper next to your face, use a freaking penny.
And aren't they
copper.
Actually worth less than 1 cent pennies? Doesn't it cost more to make them?
In the action.
No, so, oh, no, so up until whatever it was, 1982 or so, 1984, when they were all copper, they were solid copper, there was about 1.7 cents of copper in a 1 cent penny. And so it wasn't worth it. So then they went over to zinc. And so now they're mostly zinc and just coated with copper, and they cost less than a penny now.
Gotcha.
In terms of the raw material.
But if you want a pure copper penny, just get an old penny and hold it up to your face.
Yeah. But either way, it's coated with copper. That's good. And you know what? Another thing is zinc works too. Zinc is not quite as good as copper, but zinc has the same effect.
Right.
And which is why, like, all the crappy homeopathic and whatever cold medicines
claims
are zinc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they include zinc, right. Yeah. Right. And brass, which is copper and zinc. Alloy.
Hey, that's even better.
It's like, naturally bactericidal. So that's
also,
good for all like brass instruments so that the your saliva won't won't retain the germs.
But now it's probably good to make that disclaimer that just because something is naturally bactericidal doesn't mean if you drink it, it will cure you. So please don't eat these things. They're very dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. This is not for internal use. The idea here is only external use. It's just to keep them from surviving on surfaces, right? I think that's the reasonable application here. Just this $70 little wand of copper, I think, is a ripoff.
Yep. So I guess this was a case where it looked like crankery, and it actually, in a way, turned out to be, but also had its kernel of truth.
Yeah, but it's based on a kernel of truth. And a lot of snake oil is. You know, they'll find some basic science thing and then extrapolate from that to a clinical application, which you can't really do. And they don't have the evidence to back up their clinical claims. It's funny, like when we write about this on Science-Based Medicine, we frequently get emails or contacted by people who are selling the stuff or work for the company or whatever, like really whining and crying and bitterly complaining about all the science we have. Like, dude, show me the study which shows that your claims are true, that shows that this thing works as you claim. That's it. Show me the study or shut up. You know, but they're like, oh, we have all these studies. You're missing the point. Your studies are not, you cannot base clinical claims on preclinical studies. Yeah. Show me the study. If we missed something. The other thing is like there's a page on their website about the science, right? Mm-hmm. I always click that tab, right? All right, show me what you got. And of course, if they have all this stuff, all the basic science, and then just all their own anecdotes, their in-house, open label stuff. It's like if there were a single, like double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial, it would obviously be on that site.
Yeah, where the hell's the JAMA article on this, right?
It would be all over the place, all over their website. If they actually had evidence that it worked, they would be all over it. So the fact that it's not there is very, very telling. I couldn't find it either, but it's always very helpful. Like if they, who have such a vested interest in finding and promoting a study like that, if they can't find it, I'm sure it doesn't exist.
Oh, and direct links to the studies and among other things, it would be it would be your banner.
Trivial.
You'd be flying it as a banner, but no.
Yeah.
Nowhere to
clinically
be found.
Clinically proven, Right.
I hate that phrase.
I know.
What does it even mean?
It's turned to a meaningless marketing phrase. I agree. It's right up there with all natural. Okay. We're going to get started with some news items. Jay, you're going to tell us how we're going to get AI to take over the world.
Cool.
Yeah, that is pretty much the ticket here. when you hear about this,
can't wait.
I suspect a lot of people in the audience will have alarm bells going off, and we will talk about those alarm bells. So the question is, how do we get AI where it is today, the current status and state of how AI functions today, where they have very specific knowledge, right? AI is good at doing what? Bob, give me an example of something that AI is very good at.
Going through lots of data very quickly and finding patterns.
Playing Jeopardy.
You wanted something
playing
specific, right?
Chess.
Yeah, playing Go, or maybe even it's getting better at facial recognition.
So, but these are very discrete, specific tasks. The one thing that AI isn't good at is having something called general intelligence, which is more like, you know, human intelligence. We're good at a lot of different things, and our brain can make associations between things, and we can deal with situations that haven't come up before. Where,
right, and that's why, Jay, you'll see initialisms like AI, which is general which means artificial intelligence, and then some people will say AGI, which is artificial general intelligence, which is really hard, and I think is something that if we ever get there, that would be one of the most major milestones you can imagine.
It's interesting that you say that, Bob, because that's what I'm going to talk about today.
Ooh.
So what do you guys think needs to happen in order for our current AI to get to the point where it's more of like a general AI?
You'd have to mimic the childhood and early adulthood of a person very quickly in order for it to know all the things that we know and take for granted, but it's so buried deep that you don't even think about it.
Feed in data that are representative of like basic human development, which is hard to do because those data sets are supposed to be discrete, right? So you have to like add stuff to the AI that you don't even think to add, like Bob said.
Well, not just human development, but interaction with an environment and a culture.
That's kind of close to what I'm about to say, Bob. So there's research that's been done recently that goes into trying to answer this question. So two scientists, Kingson Mann and Antonio Damasio from the University of Southern California, that these guys published a paper in Nature Machine Intelligence with the goal to, in quotes, inquire about conditions that would potentially allow machines to care about what they do or think. And there's a reason why they want to achieve that. So the researchers questioned the concept of robots exercising homeostasis. So similar to human homeostasis, the robot would have a idea of self-preservation, and they would monitor what they do in their environment to allow them to exist within the environment. So homeostasis for a human is, so we're eating enough, we're sleeping enough, and if any of these major things are disrupted, we do something about it. So we would feel cold, we do something about it. We were scared, well, that probably means there's creatures that can hurt us, so we go and fix that problem, and then we achieve homeostasis by being in a stable place, both mentally and in the environment. So human feelings are extraordinarily complicated, but we do understand that they play a critical role in the regulation of our behavior. So the researchers propose a strategy that would give machines their own version of feelings. And those feelings could support its ability to maintain its own survival, which is, in essence, homeostasis. Now, getting back to the idea of homeostasis, if an intelligent machine was aware of the status of its inner workings, then it could react, say, when something that falls out of acceptable parameters would happen. So for a human, that would be what? We get a cut, or, we're getting burned from a heat source. To, a thing like a computer or an artificial intelligence, or it could be even a robot that's made out of, composites and metal and all this stuff, it wouldn't be exactly the same as a human. It could be like what? Like, an internal component is wearing out that's required, or, there's lots of ways that you could interpret this right here. So Mann and Damasio believe that feelings are that missing component that would allow robots to have this general intelligence. So the researchers think that the feelings are directly tied to the human's ability to survive. And they say that our feelings are what drives us in our day-to-day, right? So our feelings and our interaction with the environment very much could be the reason why our intelligence evolved the way that it did. It was all like from the kernel of this awareness of ourselves and of the environment. And that complicated thinking is an abstract concept that is secondary to awareness of your environment or homeostasis.
So if I could summarize my understanding of this, because I read the article as well. So basically, you need AI has to be able to sense its internal state, detect that it's out of homeostasis, and then try to find creative solutions to return itself to homeostasis. And then they're arguing that in the process of learning how to essentially survive and find creative solutions, it'll develop the machine version of emotion. So I'm out of homeostasis. That's a bad thing. And then it will also have a will to survive, right? A will to return to homeostasis,
yep,
in a way. And it'll come up with creative ways of doing that.
Now, they were saying that there was two areas of development that have happened, when I say recently, probably over the last couple of decades, that they think is making this type of thinking, this advanced general thinking for machines possible. Soft robotics and deep learning. And these are two areas of study are getting more and more nuanced to the point where they're saying, listen, we can embed circuits into robots that is kind of like a nervous system, and we can have deep learning that is mimicking the wiring of a human brain a little bit, enough possibly, that we might be able to build awareness into these machines to where they're having some type of get it, you know, pull it up by its bootstrap type of, yep, they're aware of their environment, they're making decisions now that are based on this input from the environment and from their quote-unquote body to help them understand their own well-being, which would then, they think, snowball into a grander understanding of reality.
Yeah.
So they think that you need a form in order for this kind of advancement to occur, that this needs to be, like, that it's not just about sensory input to a computer, mm-hmm. but that there actually has to be an embodied cognition, like an embodied form.
Well, that would be, I think, that's a means to an end, right? If you give it this body concept, mm-hmm. or at least understanding its inner workings and having this awareness and then tying its well-being to the status of those components, you know, it's, you know, I don't know if we can't draw lines directly from like a human body to a robot body.
No.
Just
but
yet,
it could probably also be virtually embodied.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
Like,
sure,
why do we need virtual, soft robotics?
Like an avatar.
Well, let me.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's not critical.
Because they're acting. I mean, it sounds like they're saying it's one of two major components that are necessary. But it also is one of the places where we're like the most behind, like computer vision, computer sense, like audio sensation, or not sensation, but capability to discriminate between all the different kind of sensory inputs are the places where, like, we're not very good yet. Like, there are a lot of very smart people mm-hmm. working on this at some of the best universities. Mm-hmm. But this is where it's the input place where we have a bottleneck, right?
Yeah. Let me read to you something that the researchers said. They said, rather than having to hard code a robot for every eventuality or equip it with a limited set of behavioral policies, a robot concerned with its own survival might creatively solve the challenges that it encounters. Basic goals and values would be organically discovered rather than being intrinsically designed. So, yeah, I think they're trying to set up
top down versus bottom up, right?
Right. Thank you, Bob. That's a good way to look at it. You know, they want to build a process and a machine that can understand things on a level to extrapolate and think on it and quote unquote think on its own. Now,
So you're setting it up so that this complicated emergent behavior could arise.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But I don't want the solution to be to cleanse the environment, right?
Yes, it's exactly.
Something where it goes off the rails and does
or steal my iPhone to take my battery because its battery is getting low.
Totally. Skynet became conscious. What was the date, Bob? You know, like this scares me, and this is where Kara, you should say something very derogatory to the people who love technology on this show.
No, just people who are like overly optimistic. I like technology too.
Now, yes, on one hand, it would be fantastic. Yeah, it would be great to have artificial intelligence have more of this general intelligence, you know. But man, it does, to me, it just throws up a few red flags. Like, man, they better be careful because you start letting things truly think for themselves. You don't have like if it starts to become aware and starts to really think on its own. And achieve, and then we're achieving some levels of consciousness. You know, we're creating people at some point. You know,
yeah. But we really, I think, need to take. I think it's an important theoretical conversation to have, and I think it's really important for ethics committees to be concerned about this today, right? Because it is a potential eventuality. But that said, we are nowhere near what you're talking about having happen. And I think that sometimes we forget that. I would highly recommend, and this is coming from somebody who has the more psychological and neuroscience perspective, less of the computer science understanding, but I just watched, I think last week's Frontline was all about artificial intelligence, and it drills very deep, and it shows that basically the constraints and the parameters that we should be a little bit more afraid of are what large corporations are using AI for. And the eventuality that I'm most concerned about is
weapons
massive social control.
Ooh.
Massive, yeah. Social control.
You mean like what's happening in China?
They feature China heavily in the documentary. Mm. And
yeah, it's an authoritarian's dream.
It's like, sure. And there are places where there are cameras literally everywhere. They use WeChat now. Nobody carries money anymore. You can do a face scan at a little convenience store to buy all of your goods. It on the one hand, the things that seem so incredibly convenient have this amazing social cost. And, you know, just like that episode of Black Mirror where people are having like social scores.
Yep.
Oh my God,
what a great episode.
Yeah, but that's starting to be enacted. That is not a dystopian future that's happening right now.
So, Kara, I agree that that is a legitimate fear, a more pressing fear.
Yeah.
And it's already happening. I agree with that. But having said that, I think that the authors of this article are correct that what they're proposing would probably work. But it's also we should absolutely not do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I agree that I do think that they are appropriately focusing, and it's interesting that at least one of the authors is a neuroscientist. They're focusing on the fact that, yeah, this is how neuroscientific systems work, mm-hmm. right? This is how neurological systems work. You have some kind of punishment reward system. You can sense, you have the ability to sense if you're moving towards food or away from danger or whatever. And then you sort of develop behaviors to maximize those outcomes. And that has, as Bob says, you bottom up evolve an emergent behavior of general intelligence. We don't have to even get into like self-awareness or conscious or whatever.
No, exactly.
It's just it doesn't even matter. So that would work, but that's the problem, is that it may actually work. We don't want our AI developing novel solutions to really open-ended questions like its own survival.
Yeah.
Because they won't necessarily align with our priorities.
Because that is what AI does. AI develops novel solutions to problems, but so far,
but we have to keep
always been constrained.
We have to keep that on rails.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we gotta keep that on rails, man.
Yeah, but rails, fine, but you don't want to hamstring the idea of using AI and deep learning for novel solutions and, you know, for important things.
Nobody wants to hamstring. That's what AI does now.
Helping figure out what dark matter is. That's great.
That's what that.
But not the problem how it survives.
Yeah, it's the recursiveness.
Something open-ended like that. Yeah.
Oh, I would argue that in a lot of ways they already have, and they are putting so much money and research into this that it is scary, because this is the type of thing like AI, nanotech. That's the kind of thing where you don't want a country like that to be number one and be the only one that has that technology for however long they would be the only one, because that's really scary. Only you could deal with it much, much better if you also have similar technology. So I don't think it's a great idea to outright, you got to be careful what you ban, because other countries won't care what you ban.
I think it's all about
people talk about that all the time. People talk about, you guys are talking about doing some level of banning right now.
Having an ethics committee.
Yeah, it's being super careful.
And that's fine. And that's fine. But I mean, this also applies to things like nanotechnology, where if one country has like a mature class nanotechnology, then other countries are screwed. If it's a country like North Korea, then we are truly, totally screwed. But if other countries have it as well, then it becomes a much, much less of a problem.
Yeah, but Bob, you're talking about the nuclear arms race right now, and we saw how poorly that ended up, and now we want to proliferate. So I do think that there is some history that we can learn from here, that yes, there is an argument to be said that just because one country has a certain amount of technology, who are we to say that we are in any more of a moral position to possess that technology? Look at what our political situation is right now in our country. So I do think that it's kind of a dangerous proposition that an arms race is the best way to keep everybody in check as well.
I disagree. I wouldn't mm-hmm. compare nanotechnology with a nuclear arms race.
Well, we're not talking
way.
About nano. We're talking about AI.
How about CRISPR?
I'm talking about AI and
they're both analogous in the way that they could be used as, like, if you're talking about nuclear power, like nuclear technology, it could be civilian
double-edged sword,
peaceful, but it could also be, you could also make H-bombs. Nanotech could make great things, but could also turn your country into gray goo. AI, you know, we could invent Cylons, right? So, or we could cure cancer, either way. So, but Kara, I just want to say one thing. I mean, no one loves the arms race, but I don't think you can categorically say it didn't work. We never had a nuclear war.
And that's what MAD is all about, mutually assured destruction.
That we would have been better off if only the Soviet Union had nuclear
weapons. No, I can't say that categorically, nor did I. What I am saying is that we are now in a position where most people agree that deproliferation is the best way forward. So yes, maybe it had to happen. Yeah. Maybe it didn't have to happen. Nobody can know that better. But we do know that it ended up in an end game that nobody is happy with. We don't like that there are stockpiles of nuclear arms.
Proliferation is absolutely, I agree with that. But at the same time, I just say you said we all know how that turned out. But the point is, it actually, from the point of view of we managed to so far not have a nuclear war, it actually turned out pretty well.
No, but we have murdered thousands of people with nuclear weapons, and we have with atom bombs, and we have done nuclear testing that has had horrific impacts on a lot of people. And I think we can't just ignore that. And there are also massive risks.
Just for balance, I'm just saying that. So, because if you're using this as an argument of, well, we don't want to get into another arms race by racing to make AI before China does, like, well, maybe we do want to do that, though. Well, maybe we don't want China to be the only country with AI.
And the truth is, yes, China's authoritarian, but there have been many periods throughout human history where we've had good relations. We have good trade relations with China. Yeah. So it's not like it's a non-starter that we couldn't have some sort of ethics committee in which most of these powers are on board, you know?
So I think, I wouldn't put forward like America as the ethical paragon that would lead the world. I think we need international standards.
Absolutely.
We could lead in
exactly
in advocating for international standards, but like with genetics research, with
CRISPR,
nuclear weapons, anything, all these high end, really potentially dangerous technologies.
And there's a term for it, Steve. It's disruptive technologies. They're coming. Yeah. It's artificial intelligence and nanotech are two prime examples. Those are the things where you'd need international consortiums, you know, working together to make sure it doesn't get crazy.
Yeah, no Cylons, right? That's the thing. We don't want any Cylons. Okay, let's move on. Bob, the real solution to prevent AI from taking over the world is that we all have to become cyborgs.
Clearly, Steve, I'm glad you're seeing things my way now.
Join him.
So, guys, Evan brought this one to my attention. This is an interesting story. I think we might have a decent discussion. Dr. Peter Scott Morgan is a terminally ill British roboticist scientist, and he's returned home after becoming what he says is the world's first full cyborg, calling himself Peter 2.0. And he continues, when he said, "When I say Peter 2.0, I mean a cyborg. And when I say cyborg, I don't just mean any old cyborg. You understand, but by far the most advanced human cybernetic organism ever created in 13.8 billion years." So amazing claims. Where did this even come from? So with Peter, it started with this dire prognosis that he received just a couple years ago, that he had the muscle wasting disease, ALS, and would likely be dead in 2019. So clearly, pretty dire situation he was in. But instead of wallowing in pity like I would do, he's decided, actually, I may think along similar lines as to him. He decided to deal with this news, as you might imagine, a roboticist would. He wants to push science to its current limits to help him deal with and to extend his life and become fully robotic. So that was his plan. So let's see, what did he do? Yeah. What he did, one of the first things he did, he had his larynx removed. He had a laryngectomy. So basically, he took out his larynx. When that happens, you lose your physical voice. Your voice is gone. You will never speak normally ever again. So regarding that, he said, "My mini ventilator keeps me breathing a lot quieter than Darth Vader's. All speech is synthetic, but at last sounds like me again." So why did he do that? He says that this trading his voice could potentially add decades to his life. And apparently that's because You avoid the added danger of saliva potentially entering your lungs when that happens. Does that sound reasonable, Steve? Or
No, that's true. Okay. You get aspiration pneumonia.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you completely separate, if you give like a tracheostomy, right, so you're breathing directly into your trachea, into your lungs, and you completely separate that from your oral cavity and your esophagus, right, then at no point can saliva from your mouth get down into your lungs.
Isn't that what people, that's the idea. Isn't that like, there's that choice, right, in ALS. There's a time where you kind of have to choose. I'm going to get a trach.
Well, that's the ventilator.
Or I'm not going to get trach. Oh, yeah. And that's to ventilate. Yeah. Okay. So he's doing this before that choice came up.
No, it sounds like he's doing it right at the point where he had. It sounds like he was getting close. Like basically, if he didn't do all of this stuff, he would be in hospice dying.
Yeah. And he wouldn't have had a voice anyway. He wouldn't have control over his trachea or over his, larynx anyway.
Well, yeah, eventually you get like Stephen Hawking, right? You get too weak to really talk. So that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would lose the voice anyway.
But he's just starting with that. He also did what is being referred to as pioneering surgery, and what Scott Morgan considers the first ever operation of its kind. He had a feeding tube inserted into his stomach, a catheter inserted into his bladder, and a colostomy bag right in his colon. And the goal there, I believe, is to essentially obviate the need as much as possible of his muscles, the use of his muscles for eating or relieving himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be clear, these surgeries are all standard.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Right?
And he even admits that, I read through his whole website where he goes, I tried to, because the articles don't do a great job of saying exactly what are they doing. Yes, he had to go to his website. And he's like, this are all stuff that's already being done. I'm just putting it all together into a system.
So I think I think that's where he's saying that is pioneering and first ever operation of his kind. He's taking a lot of different things that people do, and he's just pretty much doing a huge chunk of it on himself, kind of all at once.
So this has never happened before to any one individual, all these things simultaneously.
And there's more. That's what I think. And there's even more. He had laser eye surgery to enable him to have perfect vision at 70 centimeters, which is not coincidentally the distance from him to his computer screen, the exact distance, so that he could focus on the computer perfectly well without any, because his contacts wouldn't work in this scenario. So he had the surgery to do away with the need of the contacts, and then so that he could see his screen, which is going to be, what he's going to be looking at a lot, probably for the rest of his life. And he did that. Now, looking to the future, I get a sense that this is what he had done. And in the future, his plans for the future are things like it says that he's investigating eye tracking, which is also not a new technology at all. I've been reading about eye tracking for a long, long time. But he plans on using it to control multiple computers using just his eyes and control his electronic bed and a special hoist to help him move. So to make him as independent as possible. So again, it seems to be that he's using conventional technology, but doing a lot of it all at once on himself. And, one other thing that he's doing, he's planning, and I don't think he's completed it, is he's developing a very realistic avatar of his face. And he did that before he loses a lot of the muscle tone, I guess, in his face. That would really change the way he looks. So he wanted to create this avatar while he still had, his old face, I guess you can consider it. And the avatar is apparently designed to, it's going to be designed to respond using artificially intelligent body language. So it's kind of be like an intelligent avatar that can respond, more like a human would than just a static, a static avatar. And I got a couple more quotes to kind of give you a sense of what his attitude is regarding all this. He says, it goes without saying that all my physical interaction with the world will become robotic, and naturally my existing five senses are going to be enhanced. But far more importantly, part of my brain and all of my external persona will soon be electronic, totally synthetic. Then from then on, I'll be part hardware, part wetware, part digital, part analog, and I won't stop there. I've got more upgrades in progress in Microsoft. Mine isn't just a version change. It's a metamorphosis. He sees this being done by a lot of people that are inhibited and handicapped due to a disease and age and what have you, and something that can make them not just live, but thrive, and which that goal unto itself, I think, is something that technology is going to play a huge and increasingly huge part in the future. And who knows, maybe we will look back on him in a generation and say, he was one of the first people to really kind of pull all this together to really improve quality of life for something that would just seem to be like a complete end, a complete end of your life. But is he really, would you consider himself a cyborg? I mean, maybe that's the main question here. Is he really a cyborg? Not conventional, I would say.
But how much, like, is somebody with a pacemaker a cyborg? Like, what's the cutoff?
Right, that's it. But yeah,
there is no cutoff.
And he was saying, he's not saying I'm the first cyborg. He's saying he's the first full cyborg. And I would argue that he's not anywhere near a full cyborg.
No,
but he's definitely had a lot.
What's a full cyborg?
But Kara, you never go full cyborg.
It sounds like he's saying he has the most multiple life saving or life extending.
Yeah, something like that.
Mechanical thing. Yeah, exactly.
Right, that are enhanced.
So this is what I think about this. Like, from one point of view, he's really just cobbling together all existing, medical interventions that we have for people who have ALS or who have other extreme disabilities, right? So there's not really, like, each individual thing is not that innovative. Okay, yeah, we put in feeding tubes and tracheostomies and, put people on ventilators and we preserve their voice if we can. They have, artificial ways of speaking, and all of these things exist. They're all things that we use to enhance the lives of people with ALS or similar diseases. But there's a couple of things that I think where he's pushing the envelope. One is, as you say, Bob, is doing so many things, in a short period of time. He's like really trying to transition fully to existence, dependent upon all these machines. But I think the real, I think, innovation here, if I had to say, there's one thing where what's new in his approach? It's that he's trying to use technology not to preserve his life as much as possible, similar to the way he was as a healthy person, but to just abandon his life as a healthy person and embrace his life as what he's calling a cyborg, but whatever. Embracing the life as, using machines to stay alive and to function and whatever. So, like, the whole idea of, like, all right, whatever, I don't want to get a aspiration pneumonia. No, just remove my voice box and disconnect my
voice from
But it's so true, and his life is so different now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that is a switch. That is a little bit of a shift in the mindset that makes sense. I think that's logical. It's like, you're not trying to preserve your previous life. You're trying to create a new life.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
That may be a better approach. So I got to give it to him for that. But, and now it's just a matter of the technology. How far are we going to be able to go with that? I think the next big thing is going to be the brain machine interface. That's going to be really when you become a real cyborg,
sure.
Right? And we're like, we're almost there. It's just that, the proof of concepts are all there. It's really just a technological thing about getting the electrodes to interface long term safely with brain tissue. That's
hardware versus wetware.
Yeah, I think we're moving towards squishyware. Yeah, towards
ooh,
wetware.
Somewhere
I think
that's
what. That's what we need. We need something that, right, Jay, will pulsate with the brain.
I did some research and I found out that my brain doesn't do that. It doesn't.
Jay's dead.
That's what your brain is telling you. Right. It doesn't do it. It's all part of the illusion.
Nothing in me other than my heart pulsates. It throbs, like it's
so many
still.
Things inside of your body
Nope, it's still.
Right
no,
now.
It's still. And it's not weird looking at all.
Nope. Not something out of a science fiction horror show. Nothing like that.
That's
la, la,
just
my
own.
La 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 la
la la. I can't hear you. La la la.
No, Evan, it's la la la. La, la.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
It's sometimes overwhelming to think about picking up a new hobby, to think about learning a whole new skill or a whole new discipline. But with The Great Courses Plus, they make it easy. It's an educational streaming service that makes learning super accessible with thousands of lectures on basically any topic you can think of, with objective, in-depth information from some of the best teachers in the world.
And the best part is you're not waiting for some class to start or stop. You could just watch these videos anywhere you want, anytime you want, from any device that you have.
So this week, guys, we're recommending checking out the course, The Search for Exoplanets, What Astronomers Know. In this course, guys, you will learn about things like why even study exoplanets in the first place, how to find them, the transits of exoplanets, the search for life on exoplanets, and also coming soon, biosignatures, moons, and more. All the things that we're going to find out in the future about exoplanets that we can't quite detect right now. So check this out. This is a fascinating listen.
Right now, SGU listeners can get a free trial of unlimited access to the entire library when you sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, this next one is really interesting. I know we say interesting a lot. Somebody pointed that out to us.
It's
because we talk about interesting things on the show all the time. But anyway, this was an article in The Guardian by a former astrologer where she talks about what that was like, right? It says basically the confessions of a former astrologer. And there were so many insightful little nuggets in there. I really do recommend that everybody read the article. You know, we'll have the link to my blog post about it in the show notes. And from within there, I link to directly to her article. It's definitely worth a full read. The author is Felicity Carter. So she has a very interesting story to tell. It's like where she started dabbling in tarot cards, and this is very, very common. It was just for entertainment purposes only. But then she was amazed at the accuracy of her own readings. So she began to feel that she had real power, and she said that that feeling was like a drug, right? The idea that you're giving an actual psychic reading and you have this magical insight into the future or people's personality or whatever. But she drifted eventually over to astrology because the superficial things don't matter, right? That's just all the gimmick. That's all the, it doesn't matter if you're reading people's butts or tea leaves or whatever. It's all the same thing, right? It's all cold reading. You know, so it's a good way of, she documents how somebody can fall into cold reading without even realizing that's what she's doing. But because she didn't completely surrender her intellectual honesty, she was able to come out the other end and realize, similar to Ray Hyman, who also like was doing palm readings and was amazed at how accurate they were, but he had the curiosity to go, I wonder what would happen if I gave people the opposite reading that the book says. And it turns out that it was just as accurate. Oh, I guess this is all nonsense.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. So Felicity went through a very similar experience, but I just wanted to point out some of the key insights that she gleaned. One is that the person who's getting the reading, they're doing all the work, right? So she said astrology, like all of the cold reading techniques, it's what she calls one big word association game. You're just telling a narrative that's all based on metaphor. This sounds like that or is like this. You know, Mars is red and red is blood and blood is war and that's it, right? So Mars is aggression. And you're just totally riffing off of this free association using these kinds of metaphors. That's it. That's what it all is. But people find that compelling, right? Like we're just hardwired that way. That's why I think we use metaphors, right, in literature.
Sure. And especially if these fortune tellers are very charismatic at what they do and spin a story or weave a tale right. that really captivates their audience, in this case, the person they're reading, and they'll buy anything that they're told at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And again, like they're making the connections to themselves, right? They're looking for the associations. And then when we think we see a pattern, it speaks to us, right? Think, oh, there's something real going on here because of this coincidence, you know? Because I'm able to make connections between one thing and the other. This is probably one of the moments where she had the eye awakening moment, where a friend of hers said that she saw a clairvoyant and that the clairvoyant told her all of these things that were amazingly accurate about herself. But she happened to have a tape. Sometimes if you go to a psychic, they'll let you record the session and they give you a tape or a cassette or whatever of the session.
Cassette.
Yeah, right. So she had a recording of the audio of the session. So they listened back to it together, and she said not a single one of the predictions that she remembered was actually made during the session. Every single one was a fiction of her memory.
False memories all over the place.
Then she started,
because of the associations that she made and the inferences she drew.
Exactly. Wow. So that was another big insight that she had. You know, it's like one is that this is all just free association. The other one is that memory then will distort it out of all recognition to make it seem more impressive than it was. But then the third one was that she began to realize how absolutely predictable people are.
Yeah.
As I wrote, everyone thinks that we're all special little snowflakes, that we're all unique, and that we have our internal lives. You guys remember George Carlin, of course, who's a great comedian.
Oh, yes.
Of course.
And he said, describing his own comedy, that he just makes observations that are universal. Sometimes they're half universal if it's like deals with men or deals with women. But it's basically things that everybody knows, but nobody knows that everybody knows it, right? So that's why it's really funny. You think you're the only person who does this stupid little thing, but actually everybody does it. And so just making those observations was a key part of his comedy. And so with the psychic reading, it's the same kind of thing where everyone comes there, they're thinking that they're unique. But she said, actually, everyone had one of a very, very small set of problems and concerns that they were worried about.
What? Money, love, and...
Yeah, right. So everyone is either worried about money, love, health, you know. And she said it got to the point where somebody could walk in the door and she knows which one is their primary concern. And so she, like, one time she threw out there, like this desperate guy walked in, and she knew that he was concerned about romance, his romantic life. And she just, before he said anything, she just said, just forget her. Let her go. You got to move past her. And the guy, like, literally fell down. He was so blown away by that. But she was just making it up based on the fact that that's what everybody is concerned about when they walk through her door, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here's another analogy. So if there's anything that is very prominent about you or your life, like for us, like we're out there skeptics, you hear the same joke over and over again from other people, right? Oh, I'm skeptical about you guys, right?
Still funny.
I know. We hear it a million times and we just roll our eyes. But everyone says
laughs.
That thinking that they're clever and they're unique and they're like the first person to come up with that joke. Right?
I laugh at Steve's voice doing that joke.
That will never get tired.
So it's the same thing. Like everybody walks into the psychic reading thinking that their problems are unique and everything, but in actuality, they've got you pegged from the moment you're walking in there for no other reason than people are all fundamentally the same and we're all highly predictable.
Yeah, who's going to the psychic because their life is in perfect order?
They're stressed, they're paranoid, they are worried about the outcomes of big life questions. But the sad thing is there are really bad psychics out there who like can't even tap into that.
Yeah.
There are some.
That's right. I know, right? How pathetic are you? You can't even fake it. You can't even fake it.
We encounter. It's always like a pyramid. Like the people who are famous are like the best at the very top.
Yeah.
And then there's all these lower layers of people of increasing number and decreasing skill and ability. And because this is the world that we live in, you know, investigating this kind of stuff, we've encountered a lot of second and third tier. Whatever, mediums and psychics, and they are just terrible.
Drunk people.
Yeah, the drunk psychic was a great one. Remember?
And we did.
DeHartma, like, was such
channeling.
A medium wannabe, and she was so terrible, and we overestimate them every time because we think everyone is going to be like the rock star version of whatever it is that they're doing, right? Because that's what you see on TV, and you expect that. And it's like, no, you're the rec center version or whatever. You know, you're so
yeah. Underestimating them would actually not be a bad thing most of the time. It would work out.
She was able to eventually see. Yeah, this is just all psychology. You know, the other thing, the other observation she made is most of the people who came in to see her as a, you know, as a astrologer, they did all the talking. Mm-hmm. You know, they just, they were just paying $50 to talk to somebody who was safe because they're like not somebody in their life or, you know what I mean?
So it was just like therapy.
Yeah, people
like really, really wrong therapy. Yeah.
Most of the people who came in to see her were just using her for cheap therapy. That's
right. Yeah. And then if you asked them later, they'd say, I barely said anything.
Yeah, she knew all the stuff about me.
Sadly, is it actually cheap?
Well, $50, right? Well, I mean, probably relatively speaking.
Well, it's actually more expensive than if you are insured and your health insurance covers, you know, and you're only paying a copay.
Yeah.
So and choose your therapist wisely. Best to get one that's trained and has a license.
Exactly. The risk is one who starts at $50 and then you, before long, you've given thousands of dollars
or
to
hundreds of thousands. Yeah, that's
or that they give you really terrible life advice or that they somehow re-traumatize you during the experience. Yeah. Like, obviously, yeah, there's a lot of risk there.
Yeah, so basically you're getting – you think you're getting cheap therapy, but you're getting expensive incompetent therapy from somebody who's not trained and could easily be causing more harm than good. And they're reinforcing belief in magic, which makes you vulnerable to the actual con artists out there who will take you for everything that you have if you give them the opportunity. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But she ended with something else that I agree with. She's like, she predicted, talk about big data, AI and big data. It's like, think about it, guys. There are going to be astrology apps that are using big data to customer feedback to hone their readings. There are going to be pseudoscientific reading type apps that actually work because they're basically big data and AI.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what we have now with targeted ads.
I know, that's instead of exactly
reading, yeah, your emotions, they are to some extent even getting good enough to read your emotions to be like, oh, you're sad. Now is the time to buy more stuff.
Yeah, we were just talking about this, but instead of a totalitarian government, it's going to be your astrologer who's using big data in order to fool you and to control
your life.
Imagine
a deep learning psychic app. Oh, boy.
That's exactly what she
Yeah, but you wouldn't even need that. I mean, what? You'd have like 12 or 15 templates that you could apply to anybody, and that would be your data set.
Yeah, that's true.
So we're actually doing a very low-tech version of this for the extravaganza, you know, where we're going to use a psychic wheel to do an automated psychic reading just to show how easy it is with a very low-tech randomization device. We'll see how that works.
Is it kind of like that really famous study where the professor gave all of the kids the exact same reading?
Right.
And then everybody rated how much it matched them, and then they realized they all read the exact same thing.
Yeah. So this is basic human psychology, and it's really important to understand this because otherwise you're vulnerable to all this sort of stuff. Okay. And speaking about mental health, Kara.
Yes.
See, there is a sort of bizarre logic to the order of these news items. I understand that if I visit a national park, that it's good for my mental health.
Yes. Well, I think that it is safe to say that there is a high correlation. I'm not sure that we can, you know, completely draw a causal line yet, but there is a new study. It's an open access study, so anybody can read it themselves in Nature Communications, called The Economic Value of Protected Areas via Visitor Mental Health. So here's the thing. There are actually quite a few peer-reviewed studies that show high levels of correlation between positive psychological outcomes and being outside. And some of those specifically focus on national parks. So, you know, places that are semi-untouched, you know, places that are kind of kept clean, kept curated, kept safe, where our tax dollars go to work, keeping these open spaces somewhat pristine for our enjoyment. And so there are a lot of studies, many of them come out of Australia, but I think there are also some American studies that show that there are massive benefits to psychological health. And it seems like the biggest variable really comes down to stress reduction. But of course, as we know, both from like a more basic biological perspective, you know, reducing levels of cortisol or reducing certain neurohormones, all the way to a more kind of functional psychological perspective, stress really does, if it doesn't underlie most mental health issues, it at least exacerbates most mental health issues. and not just mental health, physical health as well. So, you know, being outside, being connected with nature, there is a high level of correlation between that and reduction in stress and improvements in mental health. So what this study did, which is really fascinating, is they used some very complicated metrics that I don't fully understand, but they detail them really well in the study if you're interested in digging deep into that. And they basically use these kind of economic models to figure out what is the value to us as a society. What is the value of protecting spaces? So, you know, we have already in place national parks, and they looked at quality adjusted life years, which is apparently a measure in economics that's used quite often. They used a couple other ways to kind of look at the data that already exist. And they realized that $6 trillion seems to be the per annum. This is $6 trillion a year, seems to be the value, the economic value of maintaining and protecting open spaces, national parks. They looked largely at how much do they reduce the cost of mental health services and improve overall health of individuals. And so they agree, though, that this is just a model. They have no idea if the model is accurate. They tried to make it as accurate as possible. They're some of the first people to do this. So they ask openly. This is why it's an open access publication. Read this, look at what we did, see if you can make it better, more specific, see if we did some things wrong. We would love more precise methods. But there's some interesting metrics here with the $6 trillion number, because it's kind of hard to even sink your teeth into. That is an order of magnitude greater than what income comes in from tourism in national parks. It is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude greater than the budgets of protecting these places.
Wow.
So what they're saying is, not only is it incredibly important that we maintain national parks, not just for all the other reasons that most of the literature focus on, right? Like biodiversity, reducing biodiversity loss, and physical health to human safety, and let's say dark, you know, light pollution, and all these other things. You know, mainly, I think we often think of conservation, but just from a mental health perspective, we're talking they pay for themselves 3 times over. And the scary and sad thing is that we are seeing over and over, especially here in the U.S., but this is actually a study that focused on Australian visitors to national parks, that we're seeing an interest from a governmental perspective in cutting national parks and allowing drilling in national parks, in reducing budgets to support national parks. And so this study is one of, you know, a handful that's saying not only is that a terrible idea, it's a terrible idea for reasons we haven't even thought about before.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like, you know, it's interesting. It quantifies something that, you know, I think a lot of us feel.
Yeah.
And like for me, like I'm sure everyone feels this way, but I certainly think that, you know, natural open spaces are, there's just something magical about them. You know, just psychologically, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah. One thing is, like, we talk often about, like, would you go to Mars or would you go on long trips? Like, to me, the thought of being away from natural outdoor open spaces for a prolonged period of time is horrific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I can do that.
Virtual reality, baby.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it would be really interesting to look at the outcomes there, but I fear from a pure, you know, just from somebody who studied biology quite a lot and psychology quite a lot, that I fear that virtual reality is not at the place yet, and it may not ever be at the place where it really does, like the Veldt, like Ray Bradbury's The Veldt. I don't know if you guys remember that story where they're in the African savannah and it actually comes to life, and then like the parents get eaten in this big virtual reality theater.
I hate when that happens.
Ooh, I know, it's the worst.
The holodeck's malfunctioning again.
Yeah, it was basically a massive holodeck. But this idea that the visual is not the main takeaway. It's the air that you're breathing. It's the sounds. It's the fact that you don't have cell reception. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that you're bonding with your family. You're going on hikes. You're doing things that are physically challenging to your body. You're sleeping in nature. One of the things that I would guess, but it's not obviously published in this specific study, is going to bed when the sun goes down or soon after and only having firelight, waking up with the sun, you know, matching your circadian cycle without artificial light. These things are hugely impactful.
Yeah.
And being in national parks can really help with that, whether you're camping or whether you're just going and taking a walk. A couple things that the study author said that I think are really important. I just want to hit these super quickly. I think these are a couple really great quotes. Conservation benefits everyone a little, but no individual greatly. Individual health benefits individuals greatly, but society only a little. So ecosystem services value connects a global goal to a society scale interest, whereas health services value connects a global goal directly to individual self-interest, which is more influential. And that's a reason that they undertook this study.
Yeah.
If we can show people that if I go to a national park or if we maintain our budgets in national parks, it is going to make us feel better. It's going to reduce our anxiety and depression. It's going to improve our cognition, our sleep. It's going to relieve our stress. You know, all of these different correlations that we have been able to find. I think that that's a more compelling argument than saying, oh, it improves or it reduces biodiversity loss, which feels sadly esoteric to a lot of people, even though it's not. So super important, really big study, 20,000 people, learned a lot from it. You know, obviously not a perfect study because it's a model and they're just kind of trying to come up with the best way to model it. But again, like I said, they're calling for more people to add to it. And again, this was done in Australia. So just a couple of numbers. They were basically saying the annual health services value based on this, just in Australia, came out to about $100 billion in US dollars. And the costs of poor mental health in that country comprise about 10% of the country's GDP. So they're saying this would be 7.5% higher if the protected areas were not protected in the future. Like, these are massive, massive benefits. And so, yeah, it's important. And hopefully our representatives are reading this.
Thanks, Kara. All right. So, Evan, can we make meat out of air? Would that solve our meat problem?
Well, maybe yesterday, no, but today, yes.
Mm-hmm. What?
You know why?
Explain yourself.
Well, because it's not like there's been much recent discussion and feedback from our listeners lately about studies involving meat. Nothing like that's been happening for the last 4 weeks. But news has come down from up higheth above, that there is an alternative to animal meat. It's made from air, air-based meat. This was announced today. A San Francisco-based company called Air Protein said this: for the first time in history, air-based meat has been created from elements found in the air we breathe. Air-based meat is produced without the traditional land, water, and weather requirements. The process to create this new form of protein uses elements found in the air and is combined with water and mineral nutrients. It uses renewable energy and a probiotic production process to convert the elements into a nutrient-rich protein with the same amino acid profile as an animal protein, also fortified with crucial B vitamins.
Okay, so it's not actually meat. It's meat.
No.
It's a meat substitute, like Impossible Burger.
Correct. Okay. Right. But is it actually are we actually pulling molecules out of the air and turning them into meat? Well, you know, isn't this what plants do? And we make, you know, alternative meat products out of plants such as soy. So what exactly is new here that they're talking about?
Well, this is what I don't understand. Where's their source material? They're obviously not taking ambient air. Are they grabbing it? Where are they grabbing? Like, that plastic company that does the quote-unquote air plastic, what they're really doing is capturing methane off gases from farms, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like really concentrated methane.
Well, they said they're using CO2, oxygen, and nitrogen combined with water and minerals. So
really it's all the minerals they're adding, or they're producing the amino acids from them. I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, you think biology is, you know, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, right? That's basically what we're made out of. So if you get nitrogen from the air, carbon from the air, oxygen from the air, and then you add water, there's your hydrogen and more oxygen, then you could basically, if you could theoretically use that as source material to make any you know, biological substance.
But yeah, is this less expensive, though, than just
inefficient.
Doing it?
Exactly.
Yeah, how efficient is this?
The fact that you could do this is not the question, right? The question is, because as Evan says, I do this all the time. I make food out of air and water and minerals in my garden, right? So the question is, how does it compare in terms of efficiency? That's all we need to know.
And the efficiency question is really complicated, right? How much water?
You might imagine that this would be great in a land limited situation or on a space station or something.
That's part of their claim. Tiny fraction of the land used when you're comparing it to traditional meat production.
But
how much air do you need to go into like a burger patty?
I don't know.
Probably
all of the air on the planet. What I'm kind of confused about. It does seem like, unfortunately, a cow is a really efficient carrier for protein.
Yeah, how much does air weigh? I mean, that would be a good way to sort of estimate that. Like the air in a room, how much does it weigh?
0.08 pounds, 1 cubic foot of air.
So you need like 15, or so cubic feet of air to make a pound of meat. But also you're adding water.
That's with 100% efficiency.
Well, I'm just saying. Actually, it might even be less than that because a lot of that weight could come from water. Remember, they're adding water.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, yeah.
Well, that's bullshit right there. That's one of the reasons that it's not efficient is that we have to add water to cows.
Yeah. Well, look at any of these alternative meat products. Water is one of the primary ingredients in all of these things.
Yeah.
Beyond
I think
meat,
for
Impossible Burger, all of them.
The issue here is not that we're using fewer resources. The issue is that we're creating less emissions, right?
Yes.
Isn't that the main issue?
Right. And they always get around that by saying, and we'll power this with renewable energy. It's like, whatever. You could power anything with renewable energy.
Yeah, why don't we just power factory farms with renewable energy?
Yeah, I know.
It won't be an issue.
An incidental point. It's not intrinsic to your process. It's just...
Plus, what is the air meat going to taste like? I mean, is it going to taste more like a veggie burger?
Meaty.
Yeah,
which is not very meat tasting at all. Or is it going to be something closer to the Impossible Burger, which is much closer to a meat taste?
It's not even a half-baked idea. It's like a 1% baked idea. Yeah. So let's see the meat.
Where's the beef?
Where's the beef, guys? Is this protein... how good is this protein as a source material for fake meat? That's one question. But really, if you look at all of the efficiencies, the land efficiency, energy efficiency, emission efficiency, cost efficiency, is it worth it? Is this process scalable, right? Or is it just a laboratory curiosity? All of these questions, I think, are unanswered, and I suspect that this is going to go nowhere, would be my guess.
It will vanish into the air from whence they came.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy.
It's the sound of an inchworm that can't make up its mind. It's like going, eh.
There are noisies where I get very few entries, and there are noisies where I get a tsunami of entries, and I got so many. I had a lot of funny responses to this. My God. So one listener sent me in a video of a turtle humping somebody's shoe. Actually, two people sent in that video.
Actually, and turtles make a hilarious noise when they're having sex.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that video. I love that video.
Turtles. Kara, they take that video, and then they put it into pop music.
Oh, of course they do.
Oh, my
God. Dubstep.
And the internet. Yeah, the internet exploded. Yeah, it was ridiculously funny. I'm still laughing when I think about it. So anyway, okay. So let's reverse engineer this one, shall we? So a lot of people figured out that this was some type of noise that an animal was making. So Michael McFall said, is this week's noise a porcupine? No, it's not. But you didn't say, is it a plant? Yes, it's an animal. So we're getting in the right direction. Visto tutti. This guy is...
That guy again.
Yes, he is. He's becoming a familiar name here. He says, I guess this week only because I have committed myself to guess every week, have I mentioned that you are a tricky bastard. I think he has called me a tricky bastard before. This week's noisy is a mammal because it evokes a baby crying for food in me. So it speaks mammal. It lives in a wet region because I can hear frogs in the background. You live in North America, so I'm going to say raccoon. Visto, I love your sleuthing on this. You're using, you know, a rudimentary form of science to try to figure out information. It wasn't correct, but I continue to agree that this is the process. You have to take what I'm giving you and try to rip it apart.
Yeah.
Good guess. All right, next person, Peter McClelland. He said, I am going to guess a porcupine for this week's noisy.
Is he from the Clan McClelland?
Indeed he is, Bob. He sent me a picture of him wearing a kilt. Now he, you know, so he also guessed a porcupine, which I thought was funny because a lot of people are guessing porcupines. So I guess I got to go listen to what porcupines sound like because they probably sound like this, but that's not correct. But we have a winner from last week, and Paul Manning wrote in and says, hey guys, love the show. You guys make my commute enjoyable. I believe this week's noisy is a baby sloth crying.
Oh no.
It's a baby sloth. Somebody help him.
Baby sloth.
That's a baby sloth?
Now, just by coincidence, this is the exact noise I make when I'm getting out of bed in the morning.
Jay, this is the saddest noisy of all time ever.
He's fine. The sloth is fine. He's not unfed. He is just, like, crawling to people and wanting attention. So he's...
Is there a video to accompany this noisy?
There
because
is.
I have to see it.
Yes, there is a video. I can link you to it.
Thank you.
So thank you, Peter, for sending in the now infamous baby sloth crawling for food noise. All right, so there's always a new noisy, right, guys?
Mm-hmm.
This noisy was sent in by Craig Jakes or Jackus.
Did you say jackass?
Craig Jakes. It's J-A-K-U-S, Jackus.
Oh.
And here it is. All right, so you could guess if you guys want in your minds right now, but please, if you have a guess, a real guess, send it to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and please do continue sending in some noisies for me. I get all sorts of stuff. I got people doing stuff in their house. I got people shaking things out of bottles. I got people showing me their washing machines. You know, this is what it sounds like when I change gears on my bike. I don't mind. I'll watch the videos. I'll do it, but I will pick the best ones because that's my job. That's Steve said, Jay, pick the best ones, and that's what I'm doing. So, Steve, where would they contact me if they needed to send me a direct email? An email, say, that they can attach a sound file to.
They would WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
But don't try to send me noisies through the SGU website because you cannot attach files in there. Uh-huh. So send it to WTN@theskepticsguide. So I'll say this, because this show is coming out this weekend. Some people are canceling their tickets to some of our events, which always happens like the week before. So if you're interested in any of the events that we have, you might just pop over and take a look. You might be the lucky person that catches it right at the right time. But I'm just saying, you know, there might be a couple of seats available here and there to certain things that you never know. So just go check. Just saying.
Check it out. Go check it out.
Check it out.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Quick email this week. This one is a follow-up, not really a correction, but a sort of follow-up to a topic. Evan, you discussed a couple weeks ago on craniometry. Remember craniometry? Craniometry, the detailed measurement of distances and sizes and shapes and stuff of the human skull in order to determine all sorts of things. Now, we talked about this in the context of apps using craniometric type facial recognition software in order to make inferences about users that really can't be inferred from craniometric data. And that this is not a good look for the tech industry, given the history of the abuses of craniometry to promote basically racism. And the fact that, that Silicon Valley has a reputation for not accounting for adequate diversity in the human population when designing their apps. So we got an email from Kat from Hawaii who says, mahalo. But she is involved in using craniometry, and she took exception to the fact that we only focused on the pseudoscientific abuses of these techniques and didn't adequately point out that craniometry has perfectly scientifically legitimate uses. She writes, for example, We had a couple of emails back and forth, but this is where she gets to the meat. The discussion focused on the discriminatory application of craniometrics and did not mention the valid scientific use of it. This presents the idea that craniometrics is for discriminatory purposes only. While you did note that it all depends on how such things are used, there was no counterbalance to the racist applications. This caused the segment of the show to come across as craniometry is entirely a pseudoscience for which it is solely used for discriminatory practices. I completely understand that you all do not have a lot of time to address each topic fully. However, a better balanced introduction would have been enough for me at least to show that craniometry is a valid science with real-world applications. So, fair enough. I mean, it's always hard to know like how much of a disclaimer that we need. I did specifically say it depends on how it's used, but it wasn't. We could have pointed out more specifically this key point when this, because this does come up a lot when there are valid and invalid aspects of something, right? Like we were just talking about with the copper, right? Yeah, it does kill bacteria, just not that application that they're
That's
talking
right,
about.
That's right, copper.
That's right, copper. So craniometry is used in anthropology. It is also used in evolutionary science. So, for example, if we're trying to figure out how big of a brain Homo habilis had, you use craniometric measurements in order to figure that out. So there are just measuring the skull and inferring from that things like brain size or gender or whether or age or things like that or other features that you can derive, just physical features that you're deriving from these physical measurements, that's perfectly legitimate. What we were discussing was the racist abuses of craniometric data, and the current applications actually have much more in common with that than they do the legitimate evolutionary and anthropological uses. But yeah, it's worth pointing out. So let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. Today is, as we're recording this, it's November 13th. Do you guys know what happened on November 9th?
Apollo?
November 9th.
That was
some sort of post-Halloween.
Carl Sagan's birthday.
Oh my gosh.
When was Apollo 12?
And so the theme is Carl Sagan.
Yay!
Yay!
I don't care if I'm wrong this week.
Three things.
Apollo 12 is tomorrow, November 14th. Okay. Sorry.
Three things about Carl Sagan. Here, astronomer, science communicator, arguably one of the I don't know, best science communicators that we've had in recent decades, but certainly an iconic one. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Elon Musk donated an undisclosed amount of money, but known to be north of $10 million, to create the Carl Sagan Collection at the Library of Congress. Item number two. He was passed over for promotion at Harvard because his work was considered to be too wordy and useless, so he settled for a job at Cornell instead. And item number three, Sagan dictated all of his writing, including all of his books, to cassette for someone else to transcribe. Okay, Evan, you go first.
All right, Elon Musk. I would believe it's entirely believable. First of all three of these are very believable, so good job, Steve. Over $10 million to create the Carl Sagan Collection at the Library of Congress. If he didn't do it, I wish he would do it, or someone should do it, or we should do a Kickstarter, because I think it's wonderful. I think it's a great idea. I hope that one is science. The second one about being passed over for promotion at Harvard, because his work was considered to be too wordy and useless, settled for a job at Cornell instead. I don't know about that one. Boy, he was... It gets confusing trying to remember where these scientists all worked at some point. I mean, you have to figure at some point in most scientists' career, they pass through Harvard or MIT or Cambridge, something like that on the way to wherever it is they ultimately settled. Cornell obviously is where he did ultimately wind up. But what happened before that and why? I'd not heard this story before, so I'm leaning towards this one being the fiction because I'm not familiar with it. And then the last one about dictated all of his writing, including his books, to cassette for somebody else to transcribe. Would he do? Would he have done that? Is that something he definitely would have done? All of his writing. I don't. You know what? I don't know that this one's right, because he did a ton. Not only did he write books. I mean, didn't he? He wrote articles for Parade magazine, which was a huge thing back in the day, and I think that was weekly. Among the other places he was published, he would have had to have recorded so much. That would be so much recording and somebody else transcribing it all. Oh, boy. Well, I think that one's going to be more fictitious for me than the Harvard Cornell one. So I'm going to say that that one about the writing and the cassette recording for transcribing is going to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Oof. Yeah, none of this would surprise me terribly. Elon Musk, $10 million. For some reason, I doubt that. I haven't heard that at all, and it's just like this seems too awesome for somebody to donate $10 million for that. The promotion one for Harvard, wordy and useless. Sagan, God, I mean that really. But thinking about this third one though, dictated all of his writing. How would you actually do that? That just sounds like a horrible way to write a book. But then I was thinking you could read the entire book into a cassette, all of your thoughts, have somebody transcribe it, and then you go through the transcription and you look at it, and then you make other audio edits. Okay, page 7, paragraph 2, and then just recite his update to that paragraph. So it kind of is doable, but it's such an odd way to do a book. It's so quirky. Yeah, that one's rubbing me the wrong way. I'll go with the dictation one as fiction as well.
Okay, Kara.
I think the dictation one is probably absolutely science. I mean, think about when he was writing, guys. We didn't have word processors. Like, that's how people used to always write. They would hire secretaries, and they would dictate stuff. That's how psychological reports were written. That's probably how scientific papers were written for a long time.
Nobody used a typewriter?
Yeah, but they didn't use the typewriter. They paid people who did that for a living to use the typewriter because they were way faster at it. It's like court reporters, right? It was a skilled career. So I don't know. I feel like that was probably absolutely science. I also, there's something about the Harvard one that feels amazing to me, and I hope it's science because I do love that story of, like, you know, I feel like every great thinker really was passed over or was, like, minimized at some point in their life, and that actually drove them to do better. I also think, and I hate to say this, yes, Carl Sagan is one of the greats, but the way he writes is very public-facing, and it is very poetic, and I could see some, you know, academics not liking that because it's not, like, clean enough or, you know, he uses too many adjectives or something. So to me, that one seems like science too. The Elon Musk one doesn't rub me the wrong way either. So that bugs me. I want them all to be science. I just think this is a case of, like, I feel like I would have heard of that. I'm not sure how big of a fanboy Elon Musk is about Sagan. I feel like that might, this one seems like the fiction only because you could have easily just made this up and we would all just buy it hook, line, and sinker because we're like, yeah, Musk, space guy, sure, Sagan, Musk is rich, he can afford it. But I feel like this one was like maybe a whole cloth fake out. So that's the fiction.
Okay, and Jay.
Yeah, I agree with Kara. I would have heard about the Elon Musk thing just because, you know.
He shows up in your Google feed every time.
Yeah, I mean, I have hundreds of key phrases and things that I search on. Elon Musk is definitely one of them just because of SpaceX. So there is that component. Moving on to the second one here, the Harvard. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm kind of remembering something about Carl Sagan at Harvard. I just don't know the details. I don't like the whole, you know, they consider him to be too wordy and all that. Like, you know, maybe early on, that makes kind of sense. He started off at Harvard. Maybe he got more refined as he matured and went on to Cornell. So I could see that one happening. And then him dictating, yeah, I also liked what Kara said here, too. Yeah, you know, this was before, you know, people had word processors and everything the way we have them today. And you can't, you know, I could see him feeling comfortable doing something so analog. And I almost like it. I like that he's, if that one's true. You know, I could see him recording it. And, you know, it makes me think, where are those recordings?
Oh, yeah, that would be so cool.
Yeah, right?
I wonder if they're in Elon Musk's Library of Congress collection.
So I am going to go with Kara, and I'll go one step further and say, just because of what I said, that I think I would have read this about Elon. Yeah, maybe it happened a long time ago with somebody else. That's my guess.
Okay, so you're all in agreement with number two, so we'll start there. He was passed over for promotion at Harvard because his work was considered to be too wordy and useless, so he settled for a job at Cornell instead. You guys all think this is science, and this one is science. That is true.
Yay.
Okay.
Yep, he was an assistant professor at Harvard, and you know a lot of academic tracks, it's up or out. Like, you have to get promoted or you have to leave. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No.
You can't just Yeah. So he
no status
they did
quo.
They and it's hard to get promoted to associate professor. They make to make that leap. That's really where the big filter is right there, you know. And so, yeah, so Harvard, you know, it's Harvard. They decided that and Kara's right, you know, his genius for science communication to the public wasn't really appreciated within academic circles at the time.
It's still not appreciated in
it's
academic circles.
It's still underappreciated.
Yeah. Not in the United States, anyway.
Yeah, it's very hard to – you got to just take those adjectives out and sound as terse and boring and smart as possible.
Right. So Cornell got him. He spent his career at Cornell, you know, was a professor there, taught courses and everything, and now he's like the – crown jewel in Cornell's alumni pantheon. So Harvard could suck it, I guess.
Booyah.
It's kind of like how Netflix passed up on Game of Thrones.
Is that right?
I think so. It could be that.
That
myth,
could be. Yeah,
I'm going to Google it right
Google
now.
Urban legend.
Okay.
That can't be right. All right. So I guess we'll go back to number one. Elon Musk donated an undisclosed amount of money, but known to be north of $10 million to create the Carl Sagan Collection at the Library of Congress. Jay and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science. You think the one about Sagan dictating his books is the fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Ah!
Whoa!
Good job,
I am
Jay
upset
and
that I got it wrong.
Kara.
Yay.
Yes, right, Kara.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
Now, what is true, there is a Carl Sagan collection at the Library of Congress that was made possible through an undisclosed donation from somebody else, not Elon Musk. And who do you think that is? It was somebody else who famously is a big fanboy of Carl Sagan and who has a lot of money.
Bill Gates.
He's also into science fiction.
Oh.
Seth MacFarlane?
Seth MacFarlane. Very good.
No way.
Yes, nice. He did Cosmos, you guys.
He's
and
awesome,
he's super
man.
Rich.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
It's the Seth MacFarlane collection of the Carl Sagan and Andruin archive to the public at the Library of Congress. That's
oh,
the
yeah.
name.
And he's really, really good friends with Anne also.
Yeah. Yep.
That makes
well,
sense.
Well, they did the whole Cosmos series
yep.
together, the
yeah,
redo
exactly.
of Cosmos. So.
Yep. Yeah, that was another clue. Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, yeah, so that was Seth MacFarlane. And there's the amount of money is just totally undisclosed. I made up the $10 million bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So let's go on to number three. This, of course, means that Sagan dictated all of his writing, including all of his books, to cassette for someone else to transcribe is science. And yeah, that strikes us today as being weird that you would do that elaborate process. But people do that, man. So there are... some of my colleagues, physicians, who to this day dictate their notes. Of course, now you can use like the
well, you pick
the
up
computer.
Your cell phone. I mean, you can dictate.
Right. So. Or you could do it in like the electronic medical record system is like a dictation function in there. But, and before we had, an EMR system, we did that for a while. So I dictated notes for a very short period of time. I transitioned away from that as quickly as I could because that was horrific. I hated that. Think about it. You have to, it's totally linear. You can't go back and make corrections or you have to say, oh yeah, you know, three paragraphs ago, change this for that or whatever. Then you get a transcribed version of what you wrote and you have to go through and correct it. And it's always horrific.
Yeah, I thought it would seem not the most efficient way of doing it.
So I hate it.
Well, here's the thing. But transcription machines, like dictaphones, have a forward and backward pedal. So people who are really good, they listen and they can pause anytime with their feet and they can fast forward and rewind really fast. We use them in psychology at the clinic where I worked, and it was actually really helpful because you could just go through and read off the assessment results.
Yeah.
instead of like looking at paper and then typing next to it. And I don't know. I think it's kind of like to each their own.
I know.
You can go, okay, scratch that. No, okay, can you add this back to the section where I was talking about mental status exam or whatever. And yeah, the people who transcribe are actually super talented.
Right. But I couldn't imagine writing a whole book that way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that would be hard.
But he would do like 20 revisions. So
yeah, you'd iterate.
He would get the transcribed, typed up version of the book, and then he would hand write in the corrections all throughout, and he'd do it over and over again until he got it right.
But this also, Google Docs didn't exist back then, so let's remember that. He had no real alternative.
Before word processors, okay, I could see you have limited options. If you don't feel comfortable with a typewriter, you're gonna want to, the dictation, I guess, that's the way people
did it. And remember, you also can't go back on a typewriter. You can't cut and paste on a typewriter, and you can't even delete except when you use white tape.
Yeah. Joe Nickel, I don't know if he's still doing this, but he famously writes all of his articles and books on a typewriter. He doesn't like word processors, at least last time I spoke to him about this.
Yeah.
And he's very defensive about it. He's like, yeah, you write 8 books or however many he's written at this point in time. Then you can tell me how you like to do it. But the method works perfectly fine for him. He's comfortable with it. It works well. To me, I'd rather scratch my eyes out, I can't imagine doing any significant amount of writing not on a word processor at this point in time.
By the way, before we get 1 million emails, I was misremembering, and it wasn't Game of Thrones, which at this time is probably a much more popular example, which is probably why I inflated it.
Yeah.
And the fish became this big, but conflated it. But actually, it was Mad Men, and it was HBO that passed up on Mad Men.
Oh.
And then
AMC.
They ended up selling it to AMC. Exactly. Yeah. But originally, that was pitched to HBO, and they said they didn't want it, which at the time, everybody was like,
Mad Men was awesome.
Mad Men was amazing. It could have done really well for HBO, and it probably would have been a different show too.
Oh yeah, it could have gone an extra few levels with that.
Scandalous.
There's always story. Like, every famous person has that story of somebody who passed them over early on. You're never going to make it in this business, kid. Right, and then they become super famous. Everyone has that story.
Einstein.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Patton Clark, as they pronounced it. Patton Clark.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me for this last episode before our big trip. You guys already have one. We have like a little over a week before we're setting off.
I better start packing.
Wow,
we've got a lot to do. These trips, man, they take a lot of planning and work and logistics. And we're just like, we missed some I, we didn't cross some T somewhere. Something is going to happen. We'll get through it. It'll be fine. But I mean, that there's no way we're going to pull this off without a hitch. It's way too many points of potential failure.
That's okay. There are Amazon exists.
Yeah. We've done it before. We'll get through it.
We're good at rolling with the punches.
It'll be
though,
fine. Yeah. Mm. All right, guys. Thanks again.
Thanks, Steve.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Doctor.
And until next week. This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.